Whatever the adventure, there's a BMW engineered to take it on. The X3 delivers a striking design with agile performance. The 100% electric i4 packed with pure electric energy. Or the plug-in hybrid X5, an impressive, versatile SUV granting full control on every journey. Choose what powers your next adventure during the BMW Road Home Sales Event. BMW, the ultimate driving machine.
Hurry in for exceptional offers through December 2nd. Visit BMWUSA.com for details.
You have year-end goals. Constant Contact has what it takes to help you meet them faster. Sell more, raise more, and build real relationships with your audience with Constant Contact's digital marketing tools, all made to fast-track your success. Put the go in your 2024 goals with email, social, SMS, and customized marketing campaigns built for you in just a few clicks. Ready, set, go to ConstantContact.com and start your free trial today.
Season 2 of The Sunshine Place is the story of an experimental drug rehab for teenagers called Straight Incorporated, where kidnapping, brainwashing, and torture were disguised as therapy. It's the origin story of the troubled teen industry. How do I know this? Because I lived through it. The Sunshine Place, an Odyssey original podcast in association with Robert Downey Jr. and Susan Downey, is available now on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
97.1 FM Talk Podcast.
You know who this is, Sue? This is Shaboozy.
My baby born a Birkin. She's been telling me.
And I was watching the CMAs last night, and Shaboozy was on stage, and it was a great performance. For people who don't know, this was a huge song, Tipsy. But also, he is, and there's been a couple examples of this, he's big African-American, big black dude, and just crossing over with great success in country music. So he's got a new song called Highway, which he played last night. It was a bit of a medley, if you will.
But I'm out on the highway.
So he did Highway, and then he did a live version of Tipsy. And it was just one of those great energetic performances where you had like Keith Urban and everyone else in the crowd singing along to this.
Here comes the 2 to the 3 to the 4. When his last call and they kick his out.
I like this song.
It's getting kind of late, but the ladies want some more. Oh my good Lord.
There we go. I gotta get that part in there. And then there were other great performances, Sue, a couple of which I think you would appreciate. But first, this is Eric Church. And Eric Church did a song that was dedicated, I think it's a new song that he wrote about North Carolina. It's called Darkest Hour for the hurricane victims and people still trying to recover. He's one of my favorites. I love Eric Church. Here's the one, well, I'll get to this in a second here. First, a couple that I know that you would have reaction to. This is a George Strait tribute. This is Miranda Lambert and Parker McCollum. They did a great job on this George Strait tribute, too. And this is George proper and Chris Stapleton.
But being famous has a price. There's smoke and mirrors and neon lights.
One of the things I think people go to with these award shows is the performances, and the country shows I think are better than most at just getting performance after performance after performance on, so that was really cool. Ronnie Dunn did something with Jelly Roll, and I would say this, it was really good, but Sue, if you could see Ronnie Dunn, he doesn't look like he's aged with his hair at all because he's dyeing the beard and mustache and the hair.
That's unfortunate.
It's kind of like a little bit of a country Tony La Russa look.
Oh, no.
unfortunate. But this sounded good. Listen.
You know I'm more and more convinced the longer that I live.
Yeah, really good there. So anyway, I liked the CMAs quite a bit last
good.
Night. And I also made a decision, Sue, because, look, you know, Post Malone was there. You got Jelly Roll. Face tattoos are really a thing right now. And I was talking to Becky, and I think I'm going to get some. You can't just get one. That's the thing. Because I told her at first, you could, you know, have some input on this. And then I'm like, wait a second, I'm not just going to get one. So can I pick out a few? And then the family picks out a few. So that's kind of what I'm thinking about right now. Might be a Christmas present to myself.
What are you thinking of getting?
Well, I got to come up with that.
A bunny?
I'll get Oreo
Fred.
On my forehead. It's just got to be.
There's nothing that says tough guy more than a bunny.
You know, I passed in the hallway our friend Kevin Wheeler from the Camo X side. And Kevin, I like Kevin because he's not afraid to say anything to me. Not that most people would, but we have a great relationship. Well, right. But I told him I was getting face tattoos, and he basically said, you know, it's usually kind of badasses that get face tattoos. And I'm like, okay, Kevin, you made a great call. I accept that. I really do. But one thing here, before we get to Sue's news, I have to play a little audio here because this is kind of a fun story. You know this song, don't you? It was not performed at the CMAs.
All around the mulberry bush, the monkey chased the weasel.
Yes. This is going to get you stuck in your head, right? Do you know why
you
I'm playing this? This is really a fun story. Police in southwest Japan installed cameras because they had a kindergarten class where all these shoes were going missing. They had, you know, like one of those organizers for the shoes, and the kids would put their shoes in there, and they were going missing. So they didn't know what was going on, and they put the camera in there. It was a weasel. It was actually a weasel that was taking the shoes. Five pairs of shoes, five single shoes, 15 in total went missing from the Gosho Kodomo in kindergarten in the city of Koga in Fukuoka. I don't even know if I'm pronouncing any of that right. And then the next morning, six more shoes were missing, and they said, we thought we were dealing with someone disturbed, someone with an obsession with children's shoes, perhaps. So they put three cameras in, and they were investigating this legitimately as an incident of suspicion of theft. 4 days later, another shoe goes missing, and they comb through the video footage. They're hoping, you know, they're going to find the robber right there. And it was not a person. It was a red-pawed, sneaky weasel that could be seen approaching cubby holes that were storing the kids' shoes and then dashed off with a single white shoe in its mouth. Now, my cats do this sometimes.
Yeah, it sounds like a cat thing.
So what do they do with them?
That's a good question. Let's see
put them in their little weasel nest, Fred.
It says, well, one of the reasons... you know, I think they bring this up because it's tradition to remove outdoor shoes before entering home. So that's one of the reasons, I guess, they were in these shoe rooms. But I don't know why they were grabbing them. It says weasels are notorious for stealing and stashing.
Oh, well.
I guess they were just doing their thing, right?
Oh, that's so funny.
That's funny. And I had to play Pop Goes the Weasel. Let's do this here.
These allegations are deeply concerning.
Does the president have any comment?
We're not going to comment.
It's not clear messaging.
No. And now, Sue's News. Brought to you by Sue.
Just want to let you know that I'm still cleaning everything in my house in the new washing machine.
Is there anything left?
Fred. I keep thinking, oh, well, that's it, and then I walk by something else. So we'll see. Couch covers,
are you just trying to wash
covers.
Everything in sight to break in the new washer?
No, because it's all not been cleaned properly by the old one.
Oh, I got you. Okay.
So, and I even took the dogs to the groomer.
You put the dogs in the washer?
I put them in the washer. No, I took them to the groomer today, and they smell good. Their beds are in good shape. Michael's afraid I'm going to break the washer.
Yeah, there's nothing worse
than not going to break the washer.
You do all the blankets from the dogs, and then
yes.
You put them down, and you don't have the dogs
exactly.
Bathe. Right, that's not a good thing.
And, you know, the nail trimming, I'm not really good at.
Your dog, Fred, that
Luna.
Luna, I mean, you just throw her in the dishwasher, right?
Yeah, that
she's
seems
smaller
right.
Yeah. Yes.
On this day in history, 147 years ago, in 1877 is when Thomas Edison announced his newest invention, a hand-cranked foil cylinder phonograph, which he dubbed a talking machine. First thing he recorded was Mary Had a Little Lamb, but that's essentially albums. I mean, recorded sound, at least on a phonograph, is 147 years old.
It.
Isn't
look
that awesome?
Look what he contributed to the planet, right? That's
right?
Amazing.
Right, it's amazing. And this has a little music, because that will tell you what movie opened in New York 48 years ago. 48 years
wow.
ago, Fred.
Yep.
Dang.
Still
I
great
might have
movie.
Picked the weird
Holds
version.
Up well. Yeah,
yeah.
Well, that's all right.
All right.
Maybe this was from a slower part of the movie. More
no,
dramatic. I don't know.
It's a video. I see him running. Oh, my goodness. And then, I, by the way, never saw that one. I was too young.
Wait, you never saw the original Rocky?
Until much later.
Oh, okay.
I probably
right.
saw it, you know, 20 years ago
right.
or whatever.
Well, that's okay, though. You've seen it.
Yeah, I have seen it. And then 32 years ago, this kind of freaked me out that it was 32 years ago when Adam Sandler performed the Thanksgiving song for the first time.
Love to eat turkey. Love to eat turkey. Love to eat turkey, 'cause it's good.
I don't know why it's so damn funny. But it is, because it's Adam Sandler, right?
And he looks like he's 10.
I know, he does look young when you watch this, yeah. Well, even the stuff from, you know, back in the day on SNL, he was a baby, essentially.
Let's eat turkey in a big brown shoe.
There you go, that's awesome.
That is 32 years ago today on Saturday Night Live. Well, I wanted to play one moment from the CMAs. Okay, we played Morgan Wallen yesterday. And he won Entertainer of the Year last night.
Yeah, I didn't even really say who the winners were, but he had a big night for
and,
sure.
Yeah, and Jeff Bridges, the dude abides, was the one who presented it to him, but he mispronounced his name. Listen.
And the CMA Award for Entertainer of the Year goes to Morgan Wallen.
So, you got to wonder, though, did he know or did he just say it wrong?
I think he just looked at the spelling, which is W-A-L-L-E-N, and thought right. Whalen.
Wouldn't you kind of go over that beforehand?
Right?
Maybe
I
with
would.
Jeff Bridges you don't, right?
I don't know. I love Jeff Bridges, so it's hard for me to even say that he could do anything wrong.
I don't do a lot of these public appearance type things with emceeing and stuff. The politics got involved, so I never get invited anymore, which is, by the way, that's fine. I like to contribute my time, but if you don't want me because of my politics, that's fine. But the one thing that I was always very, very interested in getting buttoned up on is the names, because you're introducing people throughout the course of the night.
Oh, I would be totally nervous about
maybe,
that.
Maybe he met Morgan Wallen Jennings.
See, that's what I think he was thinking, though, Fred, right?
Yeah, right.
Well, not Wallen, but Wallen Jennings was in his mind. So they've been calling him Morgan Wailing all day. Singing
He's
going
to take a lot of grief about that. Everyone's going to start calling him Morgan Wallen. You know that, right?
Mark, when the girls went to see Wicked, were there? Did they talk about anybody singing along?
They didn't, but I hear this is like a thing, right?
Yeah, they're saying that AMC theaters have had to come out and say, okay, here's the thing. You can't do it.
Right.
Okay, in the movie theater, they're running a 30-second warning set to clips from the movie that says no talking, no texting, no singing, no wailing, and absolutely no name-calling. Enjoy the magic of the movies. A spokesperson says they have a long-standing policy that prohibits disruptive behavior, and but people are going really worried they're going to sing more.
Right. I think what they need to do is this became, you know, with the Taylor Swift movie, you could have separate screenings eventually. I don't know that they're going to be able to do this now, and this does get tough because the movie's so long as well. But you could have screenings that are set aside for people who do want to do a sing along, right?
It's like an interactive.
You're right. They're going to do that, but not until after Christmas Day. So if you want to sing and drive everybody nuts, but you could just go to one and sing, and everybody will sing, and you'll be happy. That kind of stuff drives me nuts.
All I know is the girls gave it rave reviews when they saw it. Alexa and Becky saw it on Sunday afternoon.
Okay, I really like that. Okay, Seinfeld. Remember Newman?
Newman.
Wayne Knight, who played Jerry's nemesis Newman on Seinfeld, has lost about 100 pounds, maybe more. And he said since then, he just hasn't gotten hired because people liked him as a large man. Mm.
Isn't that interesting?
Isn't it?
Yeah, well, I can see how that happens because we've seen examples. Like Jonah Hill comes to mind because he was always kind of the fat, funny young guy. But he's done okay, though, because he got healthier. You know, he became a lot slender. But when you have people like that are sort of in your mind as that character, I would imagine that that's a little tough because casting directors are looking for certain things.
Yeah, he was just right in Jurassic Park. Too, playing that character.
Oh, that's right, he was.
Yeah.
Yeah, he told TMZ, it takes time for people to accept you as you are. Then they find out whether or not you can still do things without being fat. So hopefully he'll find something to do. He says, it is what it is. What are you going to do? And Mark, did we talk about this on the air that Cape Fear has already been... Okay. Cape Fear has already been two movies. First in 1962 with Gregory Peck, Robert Mitchum. Then in 1991 with De Niro and Nick Nolte, who is always good in those. And now it's being turned into a TV series for Apple TV Plus with Javier Bardem, who plays the psychotic Max Cady. There is nobody better than than Javier Bardem?
There isn't anybody, and that is great news that Javier Bardem.
That's a good choice.
Because that's really encouraging. He's the best.
It will be a 10 episode series, produced by Scorsese. And who directed the 1991 movie and Steven Spielberg. So this should be something. Javier Bardem, there is nobody better. God dang it, he's the best. Okay.
He's in, you know, he plays the father in the Menendez Brothers movie, or the series that he was so good in. Really good.
AAA expects a record number of Americans to travel for Thanksgiving. I feel like they say that every year. Here's when you do not want to hit the road. They're expecting just under 80 million people to head out this year, up from 78 million. That's a lot.
Fred amongst them. Fred's traveling this Thanksgiving. You are just traveling
where? To the airport to go to?
We are flying to Cayman Islands.
That is nice. You're going to keep your secret offshore account out there and check on it? Isn't that what people do? Yeah, it is.
That's what he's doing, Sue.
Is, of course.
Fred's under the auspices of going with the family for Thanksgiving. I don't believe it one bit. That's right.
We're trying to convince him to go snorkel with the stingrays. I did that once, and I just so loved it. You can feed them. What do you say, Fred?
Can you drown doing it? Because I'm not a very good swimmer.
No, it's a snorkel. You can stand up.
Okay.
Yeah.
Then I'm,
but
I've
been told that that's like one of the best places to scuba. You said the kids are going to scuba?
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Will Marie scuba?
Oh, yeah.
Good for her.
She took all the classes. I just never took the classes.
I didn't either.
Huh.
You don't know about the classes? Fred, you can't
get certified down there if she's not certified. Yeah. You can do something there as well.
Okay, well, that's good.
This is above Fred's pay grade.
He's just staring at us.
They hand me an agenda.
Right, exactly. You get the itinerary.
That's right. That's it.
What the heck? All right, the worst days to leave for Thanksgiving. In the general, the worst time to be on the road, next Tuesday from 1 until 7 p.m. and next Wednesday from 1 until 5. And the worst time to head home is Sunday between noon and 6. So it doesn't matter, Fred. They had you a schedule. You'll just show up. And finally, in Sue's News, we do have today's random fact. Okay, this is a Thanksgiving one. Sweet potatoes and yams are not the same thing. They are two different species of root vegetable, very different backgrounds and uses. It was the U.S. government that perpetuated the error of labeling sweet potatoes with orange flesh as yams. They're really still sweet potatoes. And yams are actually uncommon in America. They're native to Africa and Asia. They have dark, almost bark black skin with purple, white, or reddish flesh. And they can grow up to 7 feet long. And they are not sweet. And that's it for Sue's News.
And ladies and gentlemen, you now have the ability, to pass the yam sweet potato quiz on Thanksgiving Day thanks to Sue Thomas and Sue's News. Everything you always wanted to know about a yam but were afraid to ask. We have coming up here Peter Svodnik, who is an editor of the Free Press, wrote a great piece about Justine Bateman and her reaction to the election. Coming up. The Attorney General of Missouri, whose name has been in the mix for U.S. Attorney General at least a few weeks ago, Andrew Bailey, is going to join us after the top of the hour. I don't hear his name very much in the aftermath of Matt Gaetz pulling his nomination. That was one of the big stories of the day, but we'll ask Andrew that story, or that question, rather, right after the top of the hour. Some of you might remember in the days after the election, I read a tweet string by Justine Bateman. Not her brother, who's far more popular these days, but she kind of came out of the closet a little bit in the aftermath of the election. And her tweet string really drew a lot of attention. And I really loved what Peter Svodnik in the Free Press wrote about this, because there's some broader themes here that people can pick up on. And he joins us this afternoon, senior editor for one of the only places that you'll find real journalism these days, the Free Press. Peter, how are you this afternoon?
Great, thanks. Glad to be here.
So what we learned a little bit here in the aftermath of the election is that Gen X broke for Trump in a pretty big way. So explain and kind of give the backstory here of Justine and why that took off and connected with so many people.
I think what she tapped into was this feeling among a large chunk of Americans in their 40s, 50s, maybe early 60s, who are sort of at the sort of peak adulting phase of their lives. They're in the sort of so-called sandwich generation. They've got kids to raise and parents to worry about, and they're tired of the all-consuming ideology, the politicization of everything, not just the obvious stuff, the pronouns and all that, but the kind of feeling that every nook and cranny of American life was becoming politicized, was becoming somehow something that somebody could kind of put under a microscope and determine whether you were a right thinker or a wrong thinker. And so I think out of that comes this this anger, this frustration with, you know, the blob, the sort of the kind of more corporatized center left, and that you know, kind of coalesced into this strong turnout for Trump.
For her, though, for Justine in particular, obviously, and I think there's a lot of Justine Batemans out there, in whether it's music or Hollywood, that really, and we're seeing this maybe even manifest itself, where people are more comfortable wearing MAGA hats, et cetera. But she did seem to speak for a lot of people who may have been afraid to, you know, to speak up about this particular moment.
Yes. Yeah, I think she gave voice to something which a lot of people are feeling, which is that you may not have voted for Trump. You may not like him or care for him, you know, on some aesthetic or even ideological level. But there is, I think, a feeling among a lot of people that they can, as she put it, stop walking on eggshells. And there's a kind of like this feeling like there's a kind of a weight that's been lifted. This is the kind of perspective that she, you know, she articulated, I think, very well. That's really sort of what she tapped into. It's the sort of, you know, finally after 4 or however many years of being careful of all the tone policing of you know, worrying about microaggressing or triggering or whatever, I'm free to be a human being again.
So, Peter, you I don't know if you exchanged messages or spoke with her on Zoom, but you interviewed her, right?
I did, yeah.
And what did she tell you about the aftermath of all this?
You know, she was pretty reserved about that. I got the sense that, you know, she definitely got some blowback. I don't know about sort of like how it's affected her, you know, personal relationships or friendships or professional relationships or anything like that. You know, obviously she's in a rather advantageous position. She's had a successful career and she's done a lot. And I think, you know, is in a position where she can kind of weigh in on these things. But there is always like this, you know, price that you have to pay for being, you know, for saying something that's going to offend a lot of people, especially people in your own industry. And for that, I think she deserves a lot of credit.
I do, too. You know, one of the things I know that she mentioned was, and we, in a weird way, we kind of feel in St. Louis that we're ground zero for a couple of these things, sadly. One with Mike Brown in 2014, and then, you know, there was a follow-up, obviously, with George Floyd. But some of that nonsense started here in St. Louis with defund the police, et cetera, and BLM. And then on the gender-affirming care, we had Jamie Reed, the whistleblower, from right here in St. Louis at Wash U and Children's Hospital. And that became a really, really big story. And, you know, I think launched a lot of this nationwide as well. But that was one of the issues that Justine brought up, right? The gender-affirming, in particular for minors, let's face it, that's what this is really about, kids and, you know, changing their bodies and their lives dramatically when maybe it's a mental illness or maybe they're just gay.
I think she said something which was very interesting to me that sounded like something I'd heard from any number of kind of run-of-the-mill Republicans I encountered over the past year or two at you know, innumerable campaign events across the country. And that was something along the lines of, look, I have no problem with any adult in America choosing to transition, but you better get your laws and your ideas, your ideology off my children and my grandchildren. And I think that, you know, what she was saying was, look, why can't we just have a conversation about these things? Why does this have to be, why do we have to be so locked up? And in a way, like what she said is in keeping with this bigger conversation that I think is happening now on the left or about the left, which is, why has there been this kind of corporatization on the left? Why is it that they said the old liberal spirit, where there used to be this kind of, you know, vigorous exchange of ideas and arguments, seems to have been eclipsed by this conformity and this, again, this rigidity. And so I think she tapped into that feeling and you know, explains, I think, a lot of why Gen X broke, I think, by something like 10 points for Trump.
Do you think she has an understanding? Because I can bring this full circle to the way that I introduced you on the show, Peter Savonik, because I feel very strongly that journalism is taking place at the Free Press and, you know, on Substack, but it's not taking place at the New York Times, which, you know, Barry left. And it's one of the issues with everything that you just discussed is because of the way that the LA Times and Latinx and, you know, CBS News and CNN, the way that they cover all these stories, you'd think that they are speaking for the masses when they're not.
Yeah, I mean, I think that like one of the things that's so troubling about legacy media is that there are tons of really wonderful journalists at a lot of the old institutions. It's just that as a group, these institutions or collectively, they have given way to a more kind of radical voice. And so I think if you were just reading, you know, the New York Times or watching CNN in the lead up to the election, you would have been shocked by what happened on November 5th. I think if you were consuming, you know, the content that we're churning out at the Free Press, you wouldn't have been shocked. You might have been a little bit surprised by the margin, but you would hardly have been shocked. I think you would have thought to yourself, well, this is in keeping with lots of things that I've been reading about and listening to and watching, and it's the kind of direction the country has been moving in for the past 6, 8, 12 months.
I agree with you wholeheartedly, which is why, by the way, I recommend the Free Press all the time. I think you guys do great. Peter, thank you so much for jumping on here with me. It was
a great column,
and have a great Thanksgiving.
Likewise.
All right, take care. That, you know, and the journalism aspect of this, it always kind of comes back to that. And the way, you know, what he just said there is very interesting. Think about the reaction from, you know, people who were, or I'm talking about the people that were crying and having, you know, moments where they needed to seek help and emotional breakdowns and stuff like that. And some of that, I think, is still happening with a lot of the left. But Sue, you remember, we played a couple of the pieces of audio, one from a professor that I played this week, one from, I think she might have been another professor that was declaring the day of the election. Remember how this was going to go? She's buying her champagne. She's ready. And they had no doubt whatsoever that Trump was going to lose and that he was going to lose badly. Oh, yeah. What's his name from the Lincoln Project was the other guy. We played the audio this week. And it does beg the question, what were all those people paying attention to? I mean, if they're watching CNN at night, here's what I'll tell you. Scott Jennings was doing a pretty good job trying to explain to people what was happening. But if you're just listening to NPR or PBS or any of the evening newscasts or the morning shows like the Today Show or CBS This Morning, well, yeah, you would be left with that impression that this is going to be a Harris blowout, I think.
On YouTube, I saw some of the CNN coverage the next day after the election, and they were shocked while it was happening. So,
right.
You know, even if you were just watching the coverage, you thought,
yeah.
What?
I think that's part of the problem. And I don't think that the legacy media out there is really learning any of the lessons from this. But that's, again, why I recommend, look, go to Real Clear Politics. You can consume a lot of interesting, different media there. You can sign up for Substack. You can also go to the Free Press, and they are really doing great reporting over there. We'll take a break. We're coming back with more in a moment on 97.1 FM Talk. Andrew Bailey in the next hour. Don't forget about that. The sun comes up, but I like myself. Yeah, that situation with Pete, not very good right now, just because the details came out. I started the show with a little bit of this, but they released the police report. And this is an emergency room nurse who contacted police in the aftermath of this alleged incident back in 2017 because she treated a woman who said that while drinking with friends after a political gathering, she may have been drugged and was then sexually assaulted. And the woman accuses Pete Hegseth. And then eventually this was investigated by police. The report is very detailed. I'm not going to get into all the, you know, the sort of details because there are sort of details in this. And the Jane Doe, the woman who is not named here, there's 22 pages of documents that were released this week. They met at a Republican conference in Monterey, California in 2017. He was the featured speaker. The story that was in the LA Times says, after observing Hegseth behaving inappropriately with women at the upscale event, she said she confronted him and the pair argued. Doe recalls Hegseth telling her that he was a nice guy. Her next memory, this is where it gets very weird. Her next memory was being in an unknown room with Pete Hegseth. She stated that Hegseth took her phone from her hands, blocked the door, and she said that she remembers saying no a lot. She says she consumed much more alcohol than normal that day. She told authorities that much of the encounter occurred after things became fuzzy. So she thinks that she was, you know, she told the nurse that she was drugged. Something was slipped into her drink. It is weird that, you know, they're arguing. He was apparently intoxicated. And then the next thing she claims she remembers is waking up and saying no, no, no in the hotel room. And then there's a few other things that I won't mention here because they get kind of gross and you can read it yourself. So he says, and he tells police in the report, that he checked to ensure that the woman was comfortable. He says that he didn't want to get into trouble, that she showed signs of regret. The officer wrote that in the police report. He did not elaborate. So the attorney for Pete even admits that his client was visibly intoxicated that evening. They have video surveillance that showed the two of them walking arm in arm. The woman was smiling. She was looking coherent. He claims that the woman was the aggressor that evening. I think that that certainly is up for debate at this point. They confirmed the description of the video footage in the documents, but they do not address the characterization of the woman as the aggressor. One witness described her as coherent and Hegseth as very intoxicated. He said that he told police he was buzzed, but not intoxicated. And then, you know, today he releases a statement because the big story today has been about Matt Gaetz and his appointment. And Pete basically said today, you know, he's not going anywhere and he's going to stick this out. But that becomes an issue with the Senate and confirmation. So I don't know what to think. All I know is that what we're hearing, Duane Patterson addressed this from hotair.com an hour ago. There's two components, as I indicated at the front. It's the details that are pretty sorted in this police report. Now, there was some settlement here, and I believe an NDA. But the other aspect is, did he tell the Trump team that this was in his background and it might surface? Because let's face it, it surfaced really, really quickly. I don't know if he's going to survive the week, but not a lot of discussion about that right now. This is also something, I didn't talk about this yesterday, but there was a piece in the New York Times. We were just talking about some of the trans issues with Peter Svodnik, and there's a lot of autopsy work being done in the aftermath of the election from Democrats on the trans issue because, you know, the they-them ad and the reference to her, you know, Kamala supporting inmates' transitions, that didn't play well with a good portion of the electorate. And I've decided, you know, I've described this whole thing as an 80-20 issue. It really is. Same thing with immigration. Most people, even we learned Hispanic people, are outraged by what was happening at the border. Same thing with crime. 80-20 issue. Look at how Prop 36 passed overwhelmingly in California. So the New York Times does this piece yesterday, and they're trying to break some of this down. And they say, since Ms. Harris's defeat, her campaign's decision has landed in the center of a contentious debate over how large a role transgender issues played in her party's losses around the country. Several prominent Democrats said Ms. Harris's relative silence was a damaging concession to Mr. Trump and evidence that the campaign was so out of step with Americans' views that it did not appreciate the potency of the ads. I'll go a step further here because I think that's true, but I also think that she was saved by even Bret Baier because she wasn't asked pointedly about women playing against biological men. She could have said something about that. No one ever asked her. And if they did ask her, it was edited out. And I think that would have been something that would have been even a bigger issue. But the notion that this played a big role with the electorate, the New York Times says, has faced vocal pushback from Democrats, particularly on the left, who warn against, you know, pining Ms. Harris's loss on her position on transgender rights in a year when voters were concerned about the economy. But there is something to this because we know that this is an 80-20 issue, and they knew this going in, and they knew that the Trump ads were working. They were very damaging. I think everyone in the aftermath of the election realizes that that was a big part of this. But the attempt by the campaign, and they get into this in the New York Times piece, was made to change the subject back to the economy. But we now know, and I think it was John Sexton who wrote about this this morning, we know that they never really got on track with that. And, you know, the Harris camp never caught up to Trump on the economy, which clearly was the voters' top issue. So now they have to decide, well, what's going to happen in 26 and in 28, right? Are we going to face this stuff on the trans stuff again? And how do we better prepare for this particular issue? So the Times runs this story and, you know, they feature people like they always do. And they're debating amongst themselves about how to handle this in the future. And then if you look at some of the responses, they're very interesting because this goes back to the 80-20 issue. So here's someone who says, what astounds me is that the articles on the important healthcare topic rarely make any reference to the medical evidence. The growing body, and this is true, the growing body of reputable, high-quality research in this area has led a majority of British, Scandinavian, and European countries to change their healthcare policies to more limited and cautious use of gender-affirming medical procedures. What I love about this comment from a reader of the New York Times is they're actually doing better work than the reporters and the journalists at the New York Times, because that's absolutely true. And what I've said in the past is, even with our situation here with Children's Hospital and WashU, there was never in the Post-Dispatch coverage or in Channel 4 or any of the TV stations, there was never an effort to lead with the medical evidence on this stuff, which they should have done. Tavistock in Scotland, there's all kinds of people. There's detransitioners that were published in the New York Times and the Washington Post and the LA Times. But there was never any effort. The effort was always there. And I'll be very curious to see if they change the tactics, because in the immediate aftermath of Jamie Reid, there was zero effort on the part of the Post-Dispatch or Alexis Zotos at Channel 4 to look into the accusations. All they wanted to do was give voice to the trans activists, not to mention that they played the trans activists off as regular parents. There's one guy that's been featured in some of the stories and in the Post-Dispatch, and he's not just a regular parent of a trans kid. He's about as alphabet mafia'd up as anyone could potentially be. So they're not really addressing some of the real issues here. Here's another one from L.A. I love when the readers are smarter than the reporters. I'd hardly call this a divisive issue. Most of the country, Democrat or Republican, agree that biological males cannot become female. Males should not be female sport. In female sports, women and girls deserve sex-segregated and protected spaces. Permanently altering children's bodies with hormones and surgery is a bad idea, etc. People got tired of having to repeat slogans like trans women are real women. And by the way, I've seen that this week all over the place with bathroom gate on Capitol Hill. Trans women are not real women. Okay? It's factually inaccurate, right? So readers are saying, look, people are tired of gender woo, like the concept of non-binary, which in and of itself is regressive and enforces sex stereotypes. So this will bring us full circle to the conversation that we had 24 hours ago today, Sue, and I'm still hacked off, confused, and frustrated by it. Jaguar goes out there and does this ad with a bunch of people that look, I guess, that they're non-binary, whatever the hell that means, and they even doubled down a little bit. Here's what it sounded like. And Elon Musk even asked yesterday, do you guys still sell cars? Here's Will Cain on Fox.
It is worthwhile. It is rational to say that car manufacturers have often sold something other than the car. Jaguar, as you pointed out, is a luxury brand, if unreliable, British luxury brand that sold aspiration. Dating back to Mad Men, you know, Don Draper, they sold sex through the vehicle of a car. What is Jaguar selling to you here? It's not aspiration. They're selling to you something that, first of all, is unoriginal. That looks like a Benetton ad from the 1980s.
It does.
It's also this identity politics androgyny that kind of went out of style, or at least fashion or trend, what, 5 years ago? So what are they selling you? Something cliched, passé, and androgynous.
Makes no sense whatsoever. I can't imagine this will be a marketing success. Will Cain agrees.
You would think that Jaguar would follow and at least learn the lesson of Bud Light, the campaign for Kamala Harris, Disney, any of the streaming services that have not catered to their audience, but to some small segment of their, I guess, ad or PR department. This will be a failure. It will be a failure like all those other attempts and businesses.
No, I mentioned yesterday, Elon Musk, right away, he was one of the first people to respond. And his response to the tweet that Jaguar sent out, or as Will says, I have to say it, Jaguar, especially since I own one. He said right away that was, I think his response was, do you guys still sell cars? They responded. Like, the official account for Jaguar responded saying, oh, yes, we do. Meet us in Miami in a couple of weeks. How they might recover from this debacle, I cannot foresee. And I take it personally because I like the brand and I've driven the brand. And now they did something stupid like this. Hour number three, Andrew Bailey, coming up next.
Get more at 971talk.com.